Welcome to the Female Dating Strategy Podcast, the meanest female-only podcast on the internet. I am your host, Savannah, and today we are continuing with our guest series from women who have applied to be the new podcast hosts. And today, it's a bit of a British takeover slash invasion on a podcast that is primarily for an American audience. Because today I am joined by Laura, who is also from the UK. So we don't have to deal with the crappy cables underneath the Atlantic causing a delay on Zencaster. Welcome, Laura.
Hello, Savannah. It's great to be here. Very excited. I hope this all goes well, but we shall see.
We shall see.
I mean, if you want me to introduce myself, basically, yep.
Yes, please do. Tell us about yourself and why you chose to apply to become a podcast host.
First of all, I'm the kind of person that I don't intend to fully get involved in stuff and then I accidentally do. And I think it's about time that we have more hosts, really, because obviously we've had a wonderful dynamic with, let's say, you, Ro, and Lilith. I loved it. But obviously, as time goes on, people do move on and then you need someone to take over, really. I think the last podcast episode was back in September. Yeah, I think it just helps to have this here for everybody because it's good to listen to, and sometimes we need the constant reminders to keep our standards because it's so easy to let all the noise and other people's opinions slowly push us back. You know, there's a lot of pushback against the strategy. And also, I mean, with the topic we're discussing today, which is genetic heritability, which is mostly from our fathers, there are a few reasons why I've chosen this. Firstly, is because there's a lot of onus on fertility stuff that focuses on women and blames us for everything. So I want to say, hey, let's look at this from a more realistic point of view. And based on my research, it also, guess what, blames men as well, because sometimes it is men's fault. It's not always our fault. And also, I've always had a slight interest in genetics anyway, because I've also looked into things like I like breeding animals, have done since I was a kid, because I am one of those unusual people. And on top of that, I have this condition where, long story short, I have debated whether or not to go, let's say, down the sperm donor route. But I guess that's more of a personal thing that's not within the topic I have given you today. But it has, looking into that has informed my decision-making process. That sounded so much more formal than I intended.
No worries. I think it's that British flair. We just have to be formal, even though it's a very informal podcast. But thank you for that intro, Laura. And yeah, I'm really, really excited about this topic because I also say, and I believe that all women should not only vet, if assuming they want to get married and have children, because not every woman wants that, and that is absolutely fine. But assuming that a woman does, it's also important to not only vet your partner as a spouse, but also what they will be like as a parent as well, as much as possible, especially if you want to have kids with them. So I'm really looking forward to learning about this topic, because when I was reading through the episode outline, I was like, I didn't know 90% of this stuff. So yeah. So Laura, tell us about the heritability. Because I noticed that you said that we apparently get most of our genetic material from our dad. So please unpack that for me, because I had no idea that this was the case.
Okay, so yeah, so one of the things FDS teaches us is that 50-50 is a lie, and it's also the case when it comes to genetics. Of course, we're always told new stuff all the time, but here's the thing. Basically, from many tens of millions of years ago, we shared most of our genetic makeup with, well, mice, basically. And what they found by studying mice is that in their offspring, 60% of the genetic material comes from the father. And they say that actually there might even be the case in humans as well. So what's annoying is you might think, oh, I've been told, for example, my friends went, well, it doesn't matter if you choose an ugly guy because you're cute.
No, it does. It does.
Sorry, it does. It does. And that in itself, the 60% heritability factor, obviously this is based on mice, so it can be inaccurate and things are always updating in the scientific journals. But if there is a chance your child inherits 60% from their father, you don't want to be choosing, like, a guy that you don't like. So I'm quite particular. Like, I don't like certain features, and other people have told me that's a weird comment. For example, like, I went, I don't like that guy's ears. And it might be something that people call you too fussy for. But seriously, if you are particular, if there is something on a guy you don't like, you are right. You can reject a man, as FDS says, for pretty much any reason, even if it seems petty, even if it seems small.
I mean, but the entire point of, like, you know, sexual selection is that it is selective by nature. I don't understand this whole idea that it should be, like, I don't know, a diversity and inclusion agenda when it comes to personal relationships, when it just doesn't and cannot work that way. You know, not everybody is gonna be, you know, I guess equally as considered as somebody else. Is it fair? No, but life isn't fair. So this whole idea that, you know, you have to be open to absolutely everybody and anyone is just absolutely absurd to me, especially for a woman as well, because I do generally believe that women have they stand a lot more to lose if they were to lower their standards just for the sake of procreation.
The thing is, some things do matter and you have preferences that you're not necessarily aware of.
Yeah, revealed biases, implicit biases, yeah.
Yeah, so there are some things that, you know how you meet someone, you have that chemistry that you can't put your finger on. And there have been times that I have met guys who would look like the kind of guy that you would want to pair me with. You're like, surely she'll fancy him. Oh, to the American listeners, basically fancy means like having a crush on or being attracted to. And there have been times where I've met a guy and it's been more like high five bros rather than any chemistry between us. And sometimes I'll actually find out weeks later that we kind of have the same underlying issue, but we didn't necessarily know it when we met. So that's a really fascinating thing that sometimes your body knows.
Even like things like sense of smell, like I've, you know, come across like guys, they would smell really, 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 really good to me, even if they hadn't used anything like deodorant, for example. They still wash, but they weren't like super into cologne, like I'm a perfume addict, right? And they still smelled really good to me. And there have been other guys who are still really hygienic, but they just don't smell good to me, like for whatever reason. And, you know, that's not to say that they were unhygienic, because they weren't. They, you know, showered and they cleaned themselves, but it's just that, you know, my nose was just not agreeing with them for whatever reason.
Yeah, you like what you like and you don't like what you don't like, and it's all for a reason, whether you know it or not. It might be even like an unconscious or a subconscious thing. I think the one important thing we should talk about first, because it's kind of the elephant in the room in terms of attraction, which is the height element, if you're happy to discuss that.
I will admit, like, when it comes to men, I am a complete heightist, like, absolute. Yeah, sorry, please continue, Laura.
No, I'm interesting because I know many women who only really prefer tall men. And here's something that I find really interesting about me.
Yes, I am one of those women.
That's fair, yes. But that's because obviously the positives of a taller man are things like that they tend to live longer. They're less likely to have cardiac issues. Oh, sorry, no, the short men live longer. I'm trying to remember the difference that I wrote down. It's hard to remember. But yeah, basically, that's it. So the tall men obviously you'll have more dating options. So that matters, let's say, if you have a son and you want a taller son. That tall men have a reduced risk of heart disease and high cholesterol, but they're more prone to cancer. So the reason you might like one or the other, or both, it might depend upon the genetic trade-offs. So for me, I like tall and short men, which really does fascinate me. Other women like, he has to be tall. But like one thing I love to tell people, many years ago, I was dating a guy who was 6'2", but I had a crush on a guy who was 5'7". Now, of course, I'm a small woman, so technically, I can pretty much date anyone on the scale of things.
Yeah, see, I'm a bit taller. I'm about 5'8", so the 5'7", it's just not going to work. Like, I have to be 5'9" and above. And I think it's really interesting what you said about the differences in health, because, again, I had no idea that actually taller men have pros and cons to being taller. But I think there was a chat in the Discord as well, is that with taller men, you can do more stuff with them, if you see what I mean, because they've got longer limbs, generally. But yeah, that was just cheeky aside, as we say. But I mean, I found those differences in like health markers to be quite interesting. And also as well, you've also got that societal perspective as well. Like there's been studies where, you know, taller men, they earn more money over their lifetime, even when factors such as weight and race are controlled for. The taller the man is, the more money he's likely to earn throughout his lifetime as well. So that's also it's not just, I guess, a genetic thing as well. It's also a societal thing in how we perceive, you know, men who are tall.
I have observed that in everyday life, that sometimes the taller men, people see them more, and therefore it's almost like, it's a bit like the halo effect, where when people say an attractive person, you assume they're also kind and all these other positive attributes.
Yeah, you assume they're the leader, right? If you see like a tall...
Yeah, you assume he's a boss, he's a leader, he knows what he's doing, he's intelligent. I mean, not necessarily, but sometimes just those assumptions, it doesn't really matter who they really are, their character and everything, because sometimes you only have to go by a very brief, short impression. Again, with me, I function a little bit differently, so I don't mind tall or short, are you cute? Like, that's kind of, I seem to like more, I'm more interested in the face than I am in the height. But I think, again, it's a preference thing, pros and cons again, because, as I said, so basically, like, the tall men, more options. The heart disease and high cholesterol, they tend not to have that as often as the short men, which does align with my family history, because there are a few short people in my family and some of us are predisposed to high cholesterol. So I can see why sometimes I might like the taller guy for that. However, I haven't written this for you, but like, there's things called an outcross line breeding and inbreeding. Obviously inbreeding, bad. Yes, I know. With an outcross, you have two genetically different people coming together. So basically, for example, a tall man with me would be an outcross. So for example, I don't have, according to my genetic data that I've looked into, touch wood, I don't have the cancer genes, right? The tall men are more likely to have the cancer genes, but less likely to have the heart disease problem. So I might choose a tall man so that we can try and both decrease our odds of having cancer and heart disease. On the other hand, with an outcross, you can get the best of both, the worst of both.
Is this basically what they mean by survival of the fittest then? Like when people, different people over time, like procreated, I mean, ancestors obviously didn't, or maybe didn't have the perhaps academic knowledge to know why they were selecting certain partners to mate with and why they weren't selecting others. But is that part of the, I guess, survival of the fittest race, in quotation marks, where, you know, subconsciously choose mating partners who will overcome different barriers, such as, you know, heart disease or cancer or...
It can be that, but here's where it gets annoying and complicated. There is no one size fits all. Because let's say I could choose the tall guy and the child could be incredibly healthy and better than both of us, hypothetically. Or on the dark side, the kid, if we're really unlucky, could end up with both heart issues and cancer. So again, so you have the risk with the outcrosses, you could end up with better genes, about the same, you know, inheriting more from one parent than the other, or worse, even worse still, the worst of both. And then you have what we call line breeding, which again, this is more related to animals, of course, where what you do is, so let's say that would be me choosing a short guy. So line breeding is where you're trying to double up on the good genes you already have. So, for example, I have 23andMe and I have it where it says, for example, long story short, I'm intelligent, basically, and I don't have addiction problems. And of course, as I said, no cancer. I might choose a short guy who has those things in common so that basically it's more likely the kids are solidly going to be fine on that front. However, because he's short, they are possibly more likely to have the heart issues. So again, you are always taking a genetic risk no matter who you choose.
That's really interesting. So, you know, when you mentioned that if you were to find your short king and you were to have children, would the risk of, was it the heart problems, would that risk come from the man or would it come from you or from both of you?
Well, I mean, in my particular case, mine's highly unusual. It's a 50-50 chance of inheriting it is what they've said, but obviously this is specialists and it's highly uncommon. It's actually come from my mother in this case, but that's the thing, is I don't want to choose someone else who has the same problem, or else this is horrendous. If I choose the wrong man, this is how intense this is, I'm not exaggerating. If I choose the wrong father, my children will die before they reach adolescence.
You sound very sure of that.
I'm very sure of that because I've looked into it. But it has to be the same highly uncommon particular genetic flaw. So I would have to be extremely unlucky to choose someone who has the same problem. But again, you see that there's kind of a, hint of fear there, but now I wonder, is that the reason why I'm actually attracted to so few men? Because the two things that kill people the most, heart disease and cancer.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, wow. This topic is so interesting. I'm not really a sciencey sort of person, but understanding, I guess, the complexities of actually selecting a partner, because I almost feel like it's just something people just never think about ever. And I remember when my siblings and I were born, because sickle cell is quite common in people of African descent. It's not common, but it's a known genetic disease within Black communities, where basically, I think it's your blood cells don't function properly. So that can lead to breathing problems and eventually death if it's really severe. And we were all basically genetically screened at birth. And then the doctor said to my dad that, you know, yeah, your children could basically marry anyone, because if that the way the gene is passed down, I don't have the specifics to hand, but basically if you have sickle cell and you have to be very careful, like who you marry, or if you have the gene for sickle cell, you have to be very careful about who you marry, because if you marry the wrong person, then your kids will have sickle cell.
And then you would feel guilty as a parent that you basically chose poorly. It sounds bad, but so like one of my issues was, so with this condition, every so often I see a specialist, I'm not exaggerating, every time I see him, are you going to have kids yet? How about now?
What a weirdo.
Yes, I know, but remember, in the medical community, for some of them, they're looking at me on a piece of paper and they're like, are you having kids yet? You know, because it's my one purpose.
Were they seeing you as some sort of science experiment?
I am a science experiment every day. Yeah, and it's like, are you planning on children? I'm like, well, I'd like to someday. It's like, okay, can you get on it sooner rather than later? Because basically I have a cholesterol problem. And they say every year my cholesterol will slowly kind of increase, like naturally. So they're telling me the risks with me having children increase the older I get. So basically I started having a little bit of freak out about nearly a year ago. This is when I looked into sperm donors. And being a super nerd and obsessive, I thought, let's look into this very, and I looked into it very thoroughly. And the problem I found with so many donors was, if I looked into them enough, they either, because of my stupid cholesterol thing, they basically had, each one either had a history of heart disease in their family, or even themselves, or a history of like being depressive or mentally unstable, mentally ill, you name it. And I was like, actually, because of my particular issue, I can't afford to try any of these men. And I'm definitely not choosing a depressive guy. I'm not having that either. So I did not see one great donor. And I was like, oh my God.
And especially since that route is so expensive, like, because I've, you know, part of, you know, we've covered, you know, men who are sperm donors before in bonus, you know, episodes, and it does seem like it's a bit like hit and miss, maybe not genetically, but in terms of some of their motivation. I think some men do genuinely sexually get off on the idea of a woman carrying their seed, so to speak, in quotation marks. Anyways, an aside, but it also makes sense now why there are such, they can be quite strict about who can be an egg donor and who can be a sperm donor as well. And I know that many short men, well, not many short men, but short men on Reddit have cried discrimination because sperm banks don't want their sperm because they're short.
But that's life. Everyone, we all get discriminated against, no matter what. I mean, I see it's one of the few ways in life that you're allowed to discriminate is who you choose as your partner.
If your standard is that you only want to date men who were born on a Tuesday at 12:36 p.m. and was from his mother's womb untimely ripped, i.e. born by cesarean section, that is entirely all right. I mean, for some reason, and I don't really know when, but people started to equate sexual discrimination. I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, discrimination based on sex. I'm talking about, like, you know, sexual selection. They tried to equate it with other forms of discrimination, like employment discrimination or gender discrimination or whatever. And they are not the same thing, because ultimately to be in a relationship with another person, to have sex with somebody else, you need the consent, fully informed consent of another person. You can't really legislate that without infringing on people's rights, or women's rights, because it'll be us, we'll be forced to prove.
A lot of things are temporary as well. So basically a job, you might be there for a couple of years and leave. And the racial discrimination that can affect you in terms of, well, again, you need to be able to make money to just survive. You don't need sex to survive. And also like a partner may not be temporary, they might be lifelong. So yes, it does matter who they choose, because again, we're looking at our potential children. I'm not just thinking about me. I have to think about my kids, then my kids' kids, their kids. You know, I'm planning for years and generations ahead. And that's how important this decision is. Whereas a job is like a few years and then it's over. Like anyone you sleep with, there's a chance they could get you pregnant. So I always see it as, if I would be upset if he was the father, then I shouldn't sleep with him. Because there's always the tiniest chance you might have an accident.
That's a good metric, just a general metric to go by, I think, when it comes to sex. And even if you live in a place where abortion is relatively easily accessible, like the UK, a lot can change, you know, between you being, I guess, like pregnant and you, you know, maybe you decide abortion isn't for you, but do you really want to be stuck with, you know, a scrote with inferior genetics?
Yeah. And the other thing is, abortions aren't always, they're not the easiest thing either. So, I mean, you might have complication, any sort of surgeries or anything, like you might have some nasty complications or side effects from taking, let's say, well, from any kind of abortion stuff. Like, it's not literally just boom, you're done. Some of these things require a long recovery.
That's true. And just, you know, being pro-choice generally, it's also, it isn't just about the right to have an abortion. It's also giving women the right to become parents if that's what they want to do.
I mean, it could sound really like super methodical and very nerdy. What obviously you've seen what I've written. It's super nerdy. So at any point, if it's too heavy or too intense, please just tell me off or interrupt me and be fun.
Yeah, tell us more. Tell us more.
All right. Okay. So I've already said about the 60-40 split where you might even inherit as much as 60% of your genes from your father. So you might be thinking, well, some genes are related more to, some things come more from your mum, some things come more from your dad. Help us out here, right? So obviously this is more towards the 50-50 split, but I want to start really with, mostly with age. So one thing that people always focus on a lot is, let's say, your age and the dad's age. What people don't always realise is it's not just the two of you. The impact really comes more so from, let's see, if we do you and him, his parents and your parents, that's six people who are responsible for the outcome of one individual. So we're not just talking about your age and the father's age. We're also talking about the age of your parents and his parents. So your age, his age, your parents' age and his parents' age impact upon the health of your unborn people. So like my example is about how my paternal grandfather, he would have been about 44, my dad's not 100% sure, but about 44 or 45 when my dad was conceived. So we're talking before I'm even born, that's already had an impact on the trajectory of my potential future health, in the fact that my dad being born to an older father would have a negative impact potentially on me. So, you know, we're looking back into like what the 1960s impacts today. It might all sound intense and dramatic, but this is literally the information we have at hand, is that it's not such a short-term thing. We're talking about epigenetics, which are where basically environmental factors and things that your parents do have an impact on you, but so do your grandparents. And the thing is, every year that we get older, we're more likely to have mutations. So basically, my grandfather, as he got older, more mutations. My dad, same sort of thing. And therefore, I'm more likely to have more mutations. So in a way, you've already got a preset thing before you're even born. And you're probably thinking, oh God, well, let's say if you're, I mean, I don't know, Savannah, how old were your parents and your grandparents?
I mean, as in like when they had me?
When you were conceived. We're not even talking about when you were born. We're talking about when you, like...
When I was conceived. So my mum would have been 30. My dad would have been 37. So my dad was older.
Now, this is the real challenge. What about your grandparents, all the four of them? So the two on each side, if you know, of course. Or generally?
Generally. Maybe they would have been... I want to say early 30s. Thing is, in Nigeria, they didn't really keep accurate birth records. So I'm just going to say they were about 30 when they had my parents, or maybe 20. Between 20 and 30, all of them.
Yeah, so relatively on the young side.
Yeah, they were relatively young, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd say maybe your dad being 37 could have a slight negative impact, but if you look at your numbers versus mine, you should hypothetically be genetically better than me. I know that sounds odd, but if we're literally looking at age, if we're basically being ageist, I mean, I think the ages were fine on my mum's side, but my mum was about, I think she was just shy of 34. Yeah, she was about 33, and I think dad was 31. So for my general age, that sounds good. But because my dad's dad had him so old, not so good, because he was one of those older dads. I mean, I know that's only one person, but just one of them can create a bit of an issue with me.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot can, I guess, go wrong as you get older. Like, the biggest example I can think of where, like, having an older father was just an absolute disaster, not just for the family, but for just general world history, is Queen Victoria's dad. So she was born when he was 52 years old. This is back in 1818. So even by that, that was really old. Like, most people didn't live anywhere near that long. But so she was born when he was 52. And it's believed that she then developed the gene for haemophilia, which then it basically spread throughout the royal houses of Europe because they inbred and they married each other. And it was a contributing factor to things like the Russian Revolution and the, I guess, the ushering in of communism. So that one had massive, massive impact. And it's not really known how Queen Victoria like came to acquire haemophilia, but it was known that her dad didn't have haemophilia because he would have been dead by the time he was 20. So it's believed that it was a spontaneous mutation when she was conceived.
These things can happen. We have, you know, the epigenetic things and we have the mutations. So I may not know a lot about haemophilia, but my personal research, which I went into, of course you have read this, the thing about where people think, oh, by 35 you should be fine. So you might think, oh yeah, well 52, of course he's going to have a child with a problem. But even when we're under 35, there can still be an issue. So one of the biggest things that I really wanted to tell people, which men may not like.
Who cares?
Oh yeah, that's a fair point. Why do I care?
Because I don't.
Okay. All right, cover your ears if you're a man, because I know you'll get all upset. The ideal age, if you are looking for the father of your children, if you really want the optimum, absolute perfect age, is a man between the ages of 25 and 30. 5 years? Yes. Did you hear that right? Yes. 25 to 30. And here's why. From as young as literally age 30, particularly in fathers, so we're not saying mums, we're saying fathers, the likelihood of conceiving autistic progeny is 1.6 times more than men under 30. So literally by the time you've turned 30 and you conceive a kid, you've already increased the chances of having autistic children. And that's the thing is, people say about, oh, there's more instances of autism. And I do think some people are being diagnosed more often. But I also think that we might be having more incidences of it because people have a bit of the Peter Pan syndrome and men just say to themselves, it doesn't matter, I'll wait till I'm a bit older, who cares? Looking at this, it does matter. And then it gets worse. If men are in their 40s, their children are 6 times more likely to turn out to be autistic. So, I mean, you're all, not guaranteeing, but you're pretty much, you're already having it skew more towards having children with disabilities, pretty much. So, if the father of your child's over 30 at the date of conception, your child will, it's not just autism, right? Your child will also have an increased risk of mental disorders like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, and even intellectual disabilities. If there's a predisposition in your family towards these issues already, you don't really want to encourage that further, let's say, by going, all right, I'm going to choose this older guy. So there are many people in my life who have said, well, why don't you choose an older guy who's ready to settle down? I've looked at the stats, I've looked at the numbers. Do I hate my kids? No. Sorry, but it's like, do I want to pretty much guarantee one of these problems? It sounds really dreadful, and But you know what? I'm like, would a man in his like 20s choose a woman in her 40s? Most of the time, no. On rare occasion, yeah, like Sienna Miller, because I think she's got a 27-year-old and he's looking, oh, he's fine. But she's a good-looking lady, so it's all good. But most of the time, if you ask a man who's in his 20s, do you want to date a woman in her 20s, her 30s, or her 40s? Most of the time, he's probably going to choose a woman who's in her 20s. So why are people trying to push me to go for men in their late 30s, early 40s? I'm not at a point where I need to.
It's also about managing your own risk as well. And again, it's just about that, you know, knowing that you can and you should be very selective, especially if you are planning on having kids with a guy. Like, because if we look at it from a social level as well, most likely going to be, you know, you'll be the one staying at home with the child. You'll be the one, you know, doing majority of the child rearing as well. So it also makes sense from a social standpoint to give yourself the best possible chance, because if there was some sort of, I guess, that defect in any way, it will usually be down to the mother to primarily manage it.
Yeah, so let's say I have a disabled child, and let's say part, obviously some of that could be my fault as well, but let's say part of it is technically his genetic contribution. The thing is, if I have a disabled child, a lot of times people pretty much kind of blame the mum for that being the case. And also, again, you have to manage it. You're the one who has to deal with it day in, day out. And I have come across people who have, not very many, of course, but a couple of people with quite children with special needs, let's say. And it's pretty much the mother is always exhausted. They don't get to go out very often. And it's like these other kids at the same age are further ahead than my child. As the child ages, the disparity between them and their peers increases, like this large gap. And again, parents feel guilty when they have a disabled child because they feel responsible for having had them. So again, as I said, intense and heavy, but it's things that parents do think about. So I think I'm at a pivotal age where I'm supposed to really kind of annoyingly, I look at the numbers, I look at the facts, and it tells me, you got to pick a man now, you know? And I'm thinking, it's really hard because I've been trying, and honestly, I'm not impressed.
I mean, you live in the UK. I mean, let's just stop the bus here for 1 second, because we need to talk about situational asexuality. And we could probably do a whole episode on this, actually, a separate episode on this with Ro, but it's particularly apparent in the UK. I'm not sure if our American followers have seen British Men. I know a lot of them are swayed by the accent, but I'm not really feeling it personally. I just feel like, I don't know, I feel like I'm asexual when I'm in, like, I don't know, parts of England. And then, like, when I'm not in those parts of England, that's when I remember that I'm actually heterosexual.
I know what you mean.
Do you get it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's put it this way. I'm on dating apps.
Oh, my God.
I know. I quit them, and now I'm trying again, because I'm literally like, I know. And I'm literally looking at some of these men.
You know when you can just feel your ovaries just shriveling up and dying? Like, that's what I felt like.
Yes, you know exactly where I'm going with this.
When I was on the dating apps, I just literally felt like my ovaries were literally, like, literally withering away. But then when I hopped across the pond to our European friends, like, my ovaries just, they came back. And they were like, "Woo, I'm here."
Yeah, basically, like, I've tried going abroad, not like it, you know. I try going, not like, you know, the passport bros. Wait, but I'm starting to feel...
I was going to say,
I'm feeling like a passport bro.
Were you like a... No, you're a passport sis.
Sorry, I didn't catch that. What's this
a
new phrase?
A passport sis. Is it a passport sis? A passport...
I'm sorry, but I'm trying. And, like, if you're looking, like, I'll find a man relatively locally, that would be nice.
I sort of, obviously, the passport bro movie, that's another hellscape. But I think, like, as women, like, especially in England, it's just such slim pickings in terms of men that A, you're attracted to, B, has the genetic capabilities to give you a healthy child or whatever. And then it's like, you have to actually get on as people and you have to not be a scrote. That is a tall order in England, so...
It's so bad. I mean, like, one of my examples is from the dating apps, right? If, let's say, we're looking at the genetic thing, granted, I can't tell if I'm attracted to somebody through a photo, but I can definitely tell you that if I don't like you, and the amount of guys who, I'm sorry, but, like, I'm in decent shape.
Don't apologise.
Oh, if you see them, you'll, oh my God, what's the most polite way of putting this? Some of these men, my dad is over 60, right? Some of these men are 30 and in worse condition than my dad.
Yeah, can believe that.
That should not be the case. Like, you shouldn't have already let yourself go before you found a partner. You know, it's like, sometimes I kind of say, you know what, I wouldn't mind if he starts, like, kind of, you know, going a little downhill once we're already married, we've done the wedding photos and all that, and oh well, at least he was cute once.
But like, Laura, when you've already gone downhill, like, you know, where else can you go downhill to though, except to hell? Like,
exactly.
I don't know, maybe I think it's also the lifestyle that we lead in the UK. It's just really...
It's not good.
Like, we have a strong drinking culture where, you know, it's almost like fashionable, like people bond over drinking the beer bellies, the fried breakfast, which is, I will say, sometimes it's like worth the clogged arteries, especially after a hangover. And we just don't really get much sun either.
We don't. So we're quite pale and washed out. And yeah, I mean, I'm a bit pale at the moment. no one cares about that. But I mean, like, we're looking at some of these men. I'm even swiping 25 to 30, the perfect age range. I'm like, wow, some of you guys have... I mean, we talk about women hitting the wall at 30. Oh, no. The men are talking about themselves.
Some men just never get started. There's not even a wall to hit. They just don't even start. So, non-starter.
Oh, literally, like, some of these men, I'm like, so many of them are already balding. I know that's not technically their fault because, again, that's tends to be inherited.
Yeah, isn't that, like, genetics or...
But even if it is, like, one of my male friends... And he said, like, it's a special hair growth formula. And he's used that to fill out his patches. And that's worked really well on him. I'm like, well, if you can discover that, that means that men can find a way. They just don't want to. Or they just want to wear hats and then they hope you don't notice that they're bald. Hat fishing! It's everywhere. And then again, as you say, the beer bellies. Like, guys, we know. We know if you have a beer belly, you have bigger boobs than me. Like, it's boobs and belly. Like, it's in the centre.
It's that dangerous fat as well, because like women,
it's white fat, not brown fat, the bad stuff. Yep.
Yes. Yeah, it tends to be the visceral fat that's actually like really dangerous
surrounding the organs. Yep, because you got brown fat, which is the good stuff, and then you got white fat, which is the bad stuff. A bit like brown bread, white bread, and the white fat is all surrounded around the organs, so basically you don't really want someone who's just big in the middle. So again, though, that's the alcoholism, and that's in a way that addiction is somewhat genetic, so like my 23andMe, I'm not really surprised, says I'm not prone to addiction. But obviously, I can see so many guys are, and alcoholism is one of the most accepted, widespread addictions that you can have, in a way, because it's made to be socially acceptable. And realistically, I feel the same way about vaping. And it's frustrating that vaping's overtaken smoking and it's seen as a healthier option when it really isn't, and that can epigenetically impact your lung function. And again, so I have been kind of seen as it's a bit mean and dismissive that, oh, you don't want this guy who's trying to quit smoking. I'm like, I'm sorry, but every guy I've ever met who smokes is not trying to quit. If anything, I've had them try and hide it from me. That's not the same thing. Or tell me that they're a social smoker. Again, not really related to age, but that can have the impact on your children.
Yeah, social smoking, that's a no. That's just like saying, like, I socially watch porn. That's not a thing. Like, you either watch it or you don't.
Yes, that's a really perfect comparison. Like, oh, it's only every so often. And they're like, not really.
I only watch it with friends. I did actually, as an aside, I did actually know a female friend in uni. She had like a circle of friends, like, but both like male and female. And they would like gather together in our flat kitchen just to watch like really fucked up porn. It wasn't like a sexual thing, it was just more like a curiosity thing. But yes, I guess socially watching porn might be a thing, but I wouldn't believe it if a scrote told me that, so yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't really. I'd take it with a pinch of salt. I mean, again, it's genetic to have a predisposition towards not just addiction, but also novelty.
Yeah, I've heard addiction can be genetic as well. When I was doing my MSc in psychology, that some people just have addictive personalities. Obviously, the environment can also play a big role, but there's apparently a genetic element to that as well, which I found interesting.
Well, I've definitely seen some people have kind of like an itch to try things. I've literally, again, this just feels like it's across the board. Like, I've been casually offered cocaine by people, and I'm like, I have no interest. I just don't even see the appeal at all. you know how, like, I can see how some people have, like, that little thing in their brain that's like, oh, I'm kind of... And that's the thing, if you have that tiniest weakness that people can see that you might be swayed just a tiny bit, they'll push. And then those are the people that might get hooked. Whereas for me, it's like, there is no wiggle room. I'm just not interested. It's just a flat out no. And so you have the vulnerability factor as well. The adventurous, the sensations. So you have sensation seeking, and then you also have, like, apparently 1 in 5 people have, like, sort of the adrenaline junkie gene. And those are the people you have to watch. Unfortunately, people like with ADHD are more likely to be those types. But if you look at it as a 1 in 5, and like, well, that's 20% of people who could be quite prone to addiction if they're not careful. So I think, let's say, even if you're an individual right here, right now, and you're listening to this and you're thinking, I do have that itch, don't even try, don't even go there. Don't scratch it.
Don't scratch the itch. Ignore it. Put ice on it.
Yeah, because literally it's very easy for you to ruin your entire life. And, you know, people think, oh, well, I wasn't an addict 10 years ago, so I'm not going to be now. If you know you're predisposed, if there's a hint, if there's wiggle room, if you're having a bad day and someone offers you something, you might say yes, you shouldn't even be there. Yeah, so there's that aspect. Okay, so with regards to age again, one of the things that might have... So the wiggle room aspect, like I said, is the over 30, children, you know, you're more likely to have like the bipolar, etc. So the mental, people with mental disorders might be more inclined to try drugs.
Just as an aside though, so you know Gordon Ramsay has just had another kid and he's 57.
Oh, he's so old.
57. I even thought it was his grandkid when he said like, but it was, he's so Gordon Ramsay, for those who are unaware, is a very famous British chef. He's sometimes across the pond in America shouting at people on Kitchen Nightmare. I definitely think he plays a character though in America that he doesn't play here, because he's nowhere near as hostile in the British versions of the show than he is over there. So I don't know, maybe they just like the the confrontational sweary Brit over there, I don't know. But yeah, he's just had a kid like a couple months ago. And his wife must be in her late 40s, I think, and he's 57.
Oh, dear. This is the other thing that I also think has an impact on women today is we're kind of, again, a little bit brainwashed by the celebrity culture. So, like, I love this couple. Their names are David Mitchell and Victoria Coren Mitchell. She's 51 and they just had a baby. I like them a lot because, obviously, they're both successful and intellectual and everything. But the problem is... because we keep being shown all these men and these couples and even older women having babies, we're kind of being somewhat brainwashed into being told it's fine, you have time, don't worry, you can wait till you're older. Or we're even kind of being told casually that just freezing your eggs or IVF is a fine backup option, as if it's just something that will guaranteed work. And I mean, one of the things that's quite sad is, like, if you look at the stats for, I mean, the listeners over who are like 40 plus or already know this, pretty much your odds of conceiving naturally by the time you're 40 are almost impossible. I think we're talking about less than 3%. And I'm like, I don't like those odds. So even with the celebrities who have everything in their favor, keep in mind they have the money and the resources. And also they may not be openly telling us if they're having any fertility treatment. There's a rare chance they might be conceiving naturally. But again, why should we take those risks?
That's true. And I also read there was an article, which I'll link in the show notes as well, but in the UK, at least anyway, I think a large proportion of, if not majority of couples who visit fertility clinics, it's usually because there's an issue with the man's fertility, but female infertility in quotation marks is easier in quotation marks to treat. But there are a lot of men who are running around with either inferior or defunct sperm who are basically infertile. But it's become like women's problem to treat that.
Everything's a woman's problem, which fascinates me because if we look at, let's say, the sperm banks again, don't they only accept about, I think it was only like 1 or 2% of all men who, let's say, give a contribution.
They're really picky. They're really picky.
Yeah, they reject so many men because a lot of guys are like, oh, I'll just make some extra cash on the side. And then they're all, as you say, upset. Oh, I'm too short. Guys, like, it's not just that, you're swimmers.
And also, like, I think it's like they look at everything as well, don't they? Because they sort of have to, like, if you're bold, if you have a degree, if you're, you know, your height, the height of your parents, like, they're very comprehensive in their screening and they will literally reject you if you don't meet those standards. And it's just like, I don't understand that a sperm bank can have all of these standards, you know, for the sperm they accept. But yeah, a lot of women either are not allowed or will accept standards that are like lower than a sperm bank when it comes to choosing their partner. It doesn't really make any sense, especially because the sperm bank doesn't have to deal with the fallout of the child, essentially, because the child will be with the mother. But you will, if you were to procreate with somebody.
An issue I have with sperm banks as well, one of the many, is like one of the top well-known ones, I watched a whole documentary on this, is called Cryos International, which I believe is in like the Netherlands, Denmark, something like that. Sorry, I watched this many months ago. And my issue with it is, the problem is, they have a lot of quality in quote marks. However, the average age there, the men are quite young, university student age. So obviously I've talked about the problem with men who are too old. Here's the thing. Men under 25 years old, right, are more likely to have children with ADHD.
Oh my God, Laura. Oh my God.
I'm sorry, I know.
You're not really selling this. I mean, I'm child-free anyway, but you're not really selling this to me at all. I mean, I wasn't expecting you to sell it to me, but it's like, it sounds like it's a little, okay. Sorry, please continue.
No, but it's literally every solution that everyone tries to tell you that seems like an easy fix. Nope. Because, like, I could choose, let's say, a 20-year-old from Cryos International. And, again, the thing is, partially, they don't really tell you how old the men are, which I find very annoying. Because, basically, like, you can kind of read between the lines. You might figure it out by, like, thingy is currently a student at this university. You'll be like, okay, he's, like, 18 to 21. But what annoys me is sometimes they also have, they either have that, or they'll have the semen from men who are, like, 40. Again, I don't want that.
Don't want that.
Yeah, so the guy who's, let's say, oh, I'm only 20 years old, oh, I'll donate some semen. Again, it's like, you might have a kid from him that has ADHD. Now, you might be like, well, why? I thought younger age men are supposed to be better. I thought younger is always better. No, because the prefrontal cortex in our brains isn't fully developed until we're 25, and it's responsible for impulse control, decision-making, and problem-solving, which is linked to ADHD. So I'm thinking, from the research, I suspect they haven't really explained fully why the connection is there, but I suspect it's technically, it's an epigenetic factor. If the father isn't fully developed, then technically that's going to transfer across to, let's say, the semen. So when you look at that, you think, again, 5 years, 25 to 30, it's a small age range, and it might be a little unrealistic depending on how old you are. But yeah, so I'm not afraid to ask men when I'm out and about, oh, how old are you? And it's funny because they don't necessarily know that what I'm really asking is your semen any good? I know, it's so bad.
You've let the cat out of the bag now, though, Laura, so.
There you go, ladies. Just be like, oh, how old are you?
Well, I mean, that was so interesting. I've never really thought about, and I guess it sort of contextualizes now why certain traits are favored in the opposite sex over others. Possibly at a subconscious level. I don't know, because like maybe we are also, our body is also aware of our own genetic limitations and that we seek out partners who don't have that. And our body just has a way of trying to detect that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, like being short people tend to, on the whole, run in my family. Though weirdly, again, I like a bit of both. So clearly, I don't know, I like a little bit of an outcross and I like a bit of line breeding. It's just a mix and match and let's find out. I mean, we've already, again, discussed height, really. But if we're talking about something like age, again, I mean, we could talk about women's age as well, if you want me to summarise it very briefly. So women's age does matter. I know we're saying this is an episode about men, but this is just information at the end of the day. So what's frustrating is, obviously, I mean, I'm 29, and what's annoying is I'm in, realistically, the pivotal age bracket. So remember how I said men under 25, we don't want them really? Well, here's the thing. As a woman, you're more likely to have issues if you conceive under the age of 23. So if you're 22 or younger, you're actually more likely to have things like issues with giving birth. So more likely to have birth complications. And again, you have a similar thing with the prefrontal cortex. Again, the man has more of an impact on that than the woman does. So you got 23 as our peak at the youngest age bracket, and the eldest peak is 32. So outside of that, not really optimal. I mean, 33, 34 is okay, but 35 to 39 can be a bit of a risk, because if you want to have two or more children, you're really kind of pushing it. So, I mean, that's the thing. I look at this and I'm like, if I was older, if I was 35, I'd be like, you got to do what you got to do. But just this window, these short few years, I'm like, I'm going to try and go for gold. I'm going to try and do the FDS route. I'm going to see if I can find a high-value man on my own right. I have no idea where to look. I have followed so much
abroad.
Literally.
You need to...
Girlies, I have tried dating apps.
That's what I did, Laura, and I haven't looked back. You need to passport sis it, sis.
Literally. Oh, so it's so bad, but yeah, we're kind of copying what the Scroats do, but like we're doing it for a good reason, not a good cause.
I mean, it's not really the same thing. I mean, they're just looking for like a woman to use and who doesn't have options. We're actually looking for a guy who we can also add value to, but he's just better looking.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, literally, I've tried the apps. I've tried things like Toastmasters. I think FDS might have recommended that once. Nope.
Yeah. Lilith was big into Toastmasters, and I've heard good things about it. But it's just, you're just in England. That's why. You're just in England. That's the biggest dating barrier, and that's the biggest ovary shriveler.
Girl, you're in the wrong country.
I could tell so many stories about my passport system, but I won't. That's just... bonus content, maybe.
I thought I was like the new one to do that, but obviously, you know what? You're never really a pioneer. You always find out that someone else is ahead of you.
I wouldn't recommend something that I haven't tried myself, Laura. So definitely, when I said the passport system, so I've been there, done that, had great success.
Hence, oh, I see the laughter. You're like, hang on, done it. I gotta say, I've got a friend that literally is like, she's talking about, she's like, oh, I need to like get a man from Turkey or Spain or something. She said like a little more suave, a little more, you know, a little smoother. They got, you know, that little more charm. I'm like, yeah, that's what our men are missing, the charm. They're too focused on our banter and negging.
I think Americans think that British men are all like James Bond.
No, almost none of them are. Don't bother, ladies.
Even James Bond is a Scroat. Like, even by British standards, he's an absolute waste man and a liability. Even by British standards, he just happens to be a spy. But how many times was he sacked from MI6 throughout the series and then just, like, hired back because they were just desperate?
I don't know. All I know is at least the Daniel Craig version was an improvement, you know.
No. How can you say that?
Because if you look at the really old versions...
Right, stop the bus. Stop the bus. We are stopping the bus here. I'm going to have this out before we finish the episode. Right, okay. State your business.
I like it. Okay. So basically, in this really old one, so we're talking like 50s, 60s, like you had... Bond would basically just like beat the women physically. Like he'd just be like, smack, off you go. And it's like, hang on a minute, that's not nice. That's literally domestic abuse. At least in the new, it's like at least hurt from no value to low value. At least in the like No Time to Die, for example, at least it was like he only really had his eye on one woman, and it's like he was trying to, yeah, he wasn't really doing his usual sort of like play the field and get with all the ladies like Halle Berry. That's it, yeah, something like that.
But that might be why, because James Bond. How old is James Bond? Let me find out.
Oh God, it's been we're talking even my parents' generation, so. There's less alcoholism presented.
So actually, no. So this is relevant to what we've just been speaking about. So at No Time to Die, I mean, so in the books, for example, James Bond, let's just go by his age in the books. He would have been about 37, right? So let's assume he was 37 at No Time to Die. This is when he was outside the optimal range for reproducing. That might have been why he'd be desperate, in quotation marks, to settle down. There you go.
Oh, I see. You're thinking. Okay. I know what you're saying. It's basically, well, hang on. He's waited until after his best, and now he's like, I know what you're saying. And then he still picks a nice, attractive young woman, obviously.
Obviously.
There are a few guys that I've met that I'm like, in one way they have potential. What annoys me is I can tell that they're not ready yet, but I'm not wasting my time on, I ain't Barb the Builder. And what annoys me is it's like, I have a feeling in like 5-10 years, at any point, if that guy literally, if one or two of these guys really pull their acts together, they could find a wife like that. And it'll probably be a younger woman who's only like 20 right now. And I kind of wonder about how, if in 10 years, will it still be the same old guys? But then You know what I mean? Like, you just end up with the leftovers.
Yeah, true. But yeah, let us know your thoughts on this episode. I must admit, I feel like I've learned an awful lot about, even though I'm proudly child-free and will remain that way, probably even more so after realizing like the short window that men have to be useful in terms of contributing their genes. But yeah, let us know what you think about heritability. And a huge thank you to Laura for coming on and sharing her knowledge with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope it hasn't been too heavy where it's like, oh wow.
No, it was really, really interesting. Thank you. So that's our show. Check us out on social media at fem.strat. We are slowly making a return to social media. I sort of took a hiatus from X after Elon Musk came and fucked shit up. It's still not the same since before he took it over. But yeah, we're slowly making our way back. So yeah, we haven't gone anywhere. FDS is still here. Thanks for listening, Queens, and for all you scroats out there.
We don't want your geriatric semen.
And you can die mad. See you next week.